at women in the political process on KPFT Tuesday afternoon.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. That means it's 5 p.m. on a Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and storytelling, right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen. I'm backed up by a talented team of story lovers. And every week, we place the spotlight on storytellers who'll take us on magical journeys through their stories. Well, today we have a special guest who was a top diplomat at the U.S. State Department for over 3 decades. And with all the ongoing chaos in the world, it's a good time to look at these government officials and see what they actually deal with. So our guest tonight will do just that. Her name is Julie Giannoloni Connor. Julie spent 33 years as a Foreign Service officer in the State Department. She held 9 different overseas assignments in 7 different countries, climbing the ladder until she reached the senior diplomat level, equivalent to that of a 2-star general. In her diplomatic work, Julie covered areas ranging from arms control to Colombian drug cartels to women's issues. And since retirement, Julie has founded a publishing company called Bayou City Press, and she's authored 2 books. So, Julie, it's good to have you here on So What's Your Story?
Thank you for inviting me, Eric, and I really look forward to talking with you and to have an opportunity to connect with your listeners.
Sounds good. So, Julie, is the life of a diplomat like we see in the movies? Are you always going to cocktail parties, cutting ribbons and ceremonies? Is that what it's like to be a diplomat in the State Department?
We frequently hear that all we do is cocktail parties, and I have to tell you, that's a big misconception. The American public gets its tax dollars out of your overseas diplomats. We work very long and hard, 8, 10, 12, 16-hour days, and we need to do that to represent American interests overseas. But having said that, I loved my career. It was an adventure from start to finish, and I would still be doing it if I were given the opportunity.
So it's not like it is in the movies, but you still loved it.
It's not like it is in the movie because it looks glamorous and really it's a lot of long hours. Now, there are some aspects you can consider glamorous, like I had the opportunity to meet countries' presidents, their top foreign affairs ministers. I had the chance to hobnob with some movie stars. But that's just a very small part of what is a long, long career with many hours every day.
Sure. Now, Julie, you started out as a country girl from Louisiana. So how did you go from there to becoming a top diplomat in the State Department?
You know, I've thought about that a lot. And in my formal presentations on the Foreign Service, I reference that. The quick answer is that I dropped out of college for 3 years and went to Europe. And having done that, I knew that I wanted a career that involved an international aspect, although I wasn't sure what that would be. But the real answer goes much further back. My grandfather spent his entire professional life working in Cuba. So I grew up hearing about Cuba, Cuba, Cuba. And I always felt cheated. I never got to get to Cuba. And then just over time, I always maintained that interest in international affairs. And when the opportunity presented itself to have a career that involved living overseas, I leaped at it.
So how did you go about the education for it and just going from wanting to be a diplomat to actually going through the process to become one?
Wow, that's an interesting question too, because I had no formal training in international affairs. I think that students who live on the East Coast, particularly Washington, D.C. and New York, have a lot better opportunity to learn about diplomacy. The main diplomacy education centers are there, and I'm talking about places like Georgetown and Johns Hopkins. But I wasn't doing my upper education on the East Coast. I was in Texas, and there's very little information here about how one gets to be a diplomat. I thought I was going to be a writer, perhaps a journalist, or perhaps a writer, and that's what I was aiming for. So that's what I thought I was going to do, but life takes strange turns, and mine certainly did. So I was a generalist, meaning I did a lot of different topic areas, but we also have specialists who do specific areas. And again, that's everything from librarians to English teaching specialists. There's just a lot of them, and many of them quite technical.
What was your first assignment as a Foreign Service officer?
Right off the bat, I went to Israel. It's an interesting fact that in my very small class, I was the person who got the lowest priority country. That is, we are asked to rank order our interest in certain countries. And I was a Spanish speaker, so I ranked the Spanish countries at the top of my list. And Israel was the first non-Spanish speaking country on my list. And evidently nobody else wanted to go to Israel. So I got it, as they have to slot everybody in somewhere. And I have Israel highest on my list, and I went to Israel. And now looking back, I think what a opportunity that I got.
Yeah, what a fascinating time to be in Israel.
That's right. Israel is fascinating all the time. I think anytime you go there, you're going to have a great tour. But I was there at the time when the PLO was very active in Lebanon, and the Israelis were having incoming rockets into their northern areas, and they were trying to figure out what to do about it. Mm-hmm. So Israel was very interested in figuring out what to do about that, and I got to watch what was going on with the Israeli process of deciding what to do, and also how they interacted with us, with the United States government, mm-hmm. as they made their decisions.
So did you ever feel like you were in any danger over there?
In Israel at that time, no. Israel is actually, despite what you might think, because of the different news things you hear, it's a very safe country, much safer in many aspects than the United States. That women can walk around the street, you know, in the dark at night and really not worry about things. Or at least the two times I've been serving there, that's how it was, which I can't say about Houston. You know, I wouldn't be happy walking in 2 a.m. in many parts of Houston as a single woman. So on that tour, no, I never felt in any danger at all. And in fact, because it was a different era, I would cross over into Palestinian areas all the time. Really? And not worry about it. But one of my wonderful experiences in that first tour was I got to go to midnight mass in Bethlehem at the Church of the Nativity. So how many people get that opportunity?
Right.
So I thought your listeners might be interested in hearing about an incident that happened on my first tour in Israel. You know, I think if you ask most Foreign Service officers, they will say they had the most fun on their very first tour. And there's reasons for that. You're young, you're enthusiastic, you're learning, and you don't have much responsibility. You're so far down the totem pole that not much flows down that you have to worry about. I mean, you're told what to do, you're guided, you're trained, but you don't have much responsibility. Now, one exception is that all officers in the embassy have to stand duty. The embassy has to respond 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So on a rotating basis, officers have to be responsible. Now, way back when I started out in 1981, standing duty meant carrying a radio around with you. It was a big thing like a brick. And you had to have it with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because if a call came in, you had to respond immediately. So one night in the middle of the night, the radio went off. And that means it's the Marine security guard calling me saying, we have a cable that you need to come in and read immediately. Now, again, this is back in the, what I call the dark ages, pre-internet, pre-everything. So we did our corresponding with Washington with what we called cables. So I got dressed, went to the embassy and read this cable, which was braided so highly it meant immediate action necessary. And I went in, I read the cable, and all of a sudden I thought, oh my goodness, what should I do? This is a very important message, but it's 2 a.m. in the morning. Should I call the ambassador and wake him up at 2 a.m. in the morning? There's really nothing he can do until open of business. So please understand, I was having to make a decision which I thought was consequential. And yet I was the most junior person at the embassy, having to decide whether to wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning, the most senior person in the embassy. And I was petrified. What do I do? What do I do if I make a mistake? You know, maybe I won't have a career in the Foreign Service. He might get very angry with me and say, I didn't exercise good judgment. So I thought and I thought, and then I had to make a decision. And I wonder what you would do in that circumstance. Would you wake him up and risk getting him angry at you? Or would you let him sleep until 5 or 6 a.m. when he can actually start conducting some business? Hmm. Well, I made a decision which was neither one nor the other. It was an equivocal decision. I opted to call not the ambassador, but the number two officer in the embassy, called the deputy chief of mission, or DCM. I called him, I told him what was happening, and let him make the decision about whether to wake up the ambassador or not. So it's, I guess one of the reasons I might have done well in my career was that I was always thinking on how to do what I needed to do, but do it in a way that would not cause really negative consequences for me.
So that incident turned out well.
It did. The phone call had to do with the fact that the Israelis were getting ready to invade Lebanon and clean out the PLO from Beirut. They wanted to get the PLO out of Beirut. And of course, the United States government had an interest in that and in how it was playing out. And our ambassador to Tel Aviv needed to Jerusalem nowadays, but back then the embassy was in Tel Aviv, needed to be able to talk with the Israeli government about it. So that was my first taste of actually having a very small, but a role in how international affairs unfurled.
That's a great story. Do you have any more stories about your Foreign Service experience, either in Israel or in the other assignments?
Oh, all I have is stories there. That's what made it a wonderful career. So let me give one of the things I laugh about nowadays at my second post, which was Paraguay. So I went from a small country, which is on the front pages of the newspapers every day, Israel, to a medium-sized country in the middle of nowhere that most Americans know nothing about, which is Paraguay. And nevertheless, the United States' interest in Paraguay is sufficient that we have a good-sized embassy there. And this time I wasn't the most junior person at the embassy. I was the second most junior person at the embassy, but I had a very important job. So putting the job aside, I'm going to talk about, at that time, Paraguay was governed by a dictator, Alfredo Stroessner. And it was my first experience living in a dictatorship. And I have to say that the dictator worked very, very hard. there was hardly a school opening or a new government building or a road being opened that he wasn't there to cut the ribbon. He worked very hard at governing that country. And one of the things he did was that on January 1st, New Year's Day, he was in his presidential palace and all his ministers and all his top officials and all of the embassies were supposed to come and give him New Year's greetings and salute him as the leader of the country. So let me just remind people that South America is on a different seasonal schedule. So January 1st in Asunción, Paraguay is the height of summer and it's broiling hot down there, just like Houston, or even maybe hotter than Houston, because there's no air conditioning, or there was very little air conditioning at that time. So as January 1st for my first year approached, I noticed that a lot of the more senior officers in the embassy were going on leave for Christmas leave or New Year's Eve, but they were getting out of town. And for me, I thought, oh boy, I'm not leaving. I want a chance to actually be there with the president of Paraguay. So as the time approached, our deputy chief of mission number two called in the officers who were going to be present and gave us a little training session on what we should expect. And basically he said, you know, all the embassy officers line up in order and from senior to most junior, and you approach the president. And he's doing this all day because anyone who's anyone in Paraguay comes that day to give him greetings. So it starts with the ambassador, and the ambassador will go up. He will bow to the president. The president will bow to him. That's, don't try to shake his hand. He's whatever age he was then, in his 70s, I think, and his hand can't take that many handshakes. So you just give him a bow. He'll give you a bow back. And then you move off to the side and the next officer comes in. So it's just a line of people progressing up, giving him a bow. If they know him, they might talk to him, but I certainly didn't know him. So the ambassador was first in our line. And when we got there, oh, and I was told, and everyone was told, don't stick your hand out. Don't force him to shake your hand. Great. So we got there. It was broiling hot. I could see why so many officers who had to wear a full suit in this sweltering weather didn't want to be there. They'd prefer to bail out after they'd done had the experience once. They would get out for vacation. But I wanted to do it. So there I am in line. The ambassador goes up. And no, he didn't shake the president's hand, but they gave each other an abrazo, if you know what that is. Men slapping each other on the back and exchanged a few words. And then the ambassador moved off and the deputy chief of mission, the number two, moved up and so forth up the line. So finally, it was my turn. I stepped up. I'm in front of the president, strictly warned, do not stick your hand out there to shake his hand. And I'm smiling at him and looking at him for a second. And all of a sudden, his hand comes out towards me. And I'm frozen. What do I do? What do I do? So what do you do when the president of a country puts his hand out towards you? So I shook his hand and I smiled and then I moved off and I was shaking in my boots again. Am I going to get in trouble with this? How can you not shake the president's hand when he puts it out there for you? And so the most junior officer who was behind me said, why did he shake your hand? And I said, I guess because I'm the only woman in this long line of people. How do I know why he wanted to shake my hand? Anyway, so it was just a little amusing incident that usually being a woman is harder because there are so few of us. But in that case, I think I got to shake his hand because I was a woman.
Well, I suppose you had to adapt to different cultures quite a bit, the difference in treatment between the genders.
Yes, just being adaptable in general is a necessary part of being a Foreign Service officer because not every place is like the United States.
So you were in Israel, and then your next assignment was Paraguay. Where did you go from there, Julie?
Well, my next post was Guatemala, and I have a not so amusing incident to talk about there. But again, it's one of my responsibilities. Let me just say that my particular specialty was what we call public diplomacy. That is, I was working with the media. I was working with the universities and other influence centers. I did exchanges, so the Fulbright exchange, the Humphrey exchange, all those different exchanges were part of my responsibility. I ran an American Cultural Center in Asunción, Paraguay. So I did with that kind of work, very important work, but I was not a consular officer. Consular officers deal with American citizens who have problems when they enter a country. And it is amazing how many American citizens have problems. They lose their passports or they get robbed or they land in jail, or anyway, consular officers deal with those kinds of issues. But as I mentioned earlier, we all stand duty. We all have to share the burden of picking up the phone in the middle of the night when there's an emergency. So I was the duty officer one night in Guatemala when I got a phone call from a parent who said he understood there'd been a plane crash in Guatemala and he feared that his child had been on that plane. And this plane was going up to the Petén, which is the area in Guatemala where there's a lot of Mayan ruins. So a lot of American tourists go up there to look at the Mayan ruins. And I had been entrusted earlier in the day with a list of the passengers on that plane, the manifest as best as the airline had it. So I had the manifest, and now I had the father on the phone, and he's asking if his son is on the plane. And I looked at the manifest, and we cannot confirm or deny anything because all we have is a name. But I had the lamentable task of telling this gentleman that I could not confirm his son was on the plane. We do not know if he actually boarded the plane, but I can tell him that there was a name, not exactly what he had given me, but a similar name on the list. And I knew at that moment that I was telling a father and a family about the death of their child. That's hard. And consular officers do this kind of work all the time.
That would be heartbreaking.
Again, the work of the Foreign Service is varied, but one of our principal functions is to assist and represent Americans overseas. And I think we do a pretty fabulous job about that based on what I have seen. And I'm not boasting on myself because I was not a consular officer. I'm boasting on my colleagues who really work hard to keep Americans safe overseas.
You know, Julie, my wallet was stolen once in Moscow, Russia, of all places. And that's who I went through, the consulate. They got my communication going with the States. I got money wired over. And I tell you, who knows where I'd be if it hadn't have been for them. So believe me, they are the people to go to if you need somebody in a foreign land.
I'm glad to hear you had a happy outcome, because sometimes the public doesn't hear about the happy outcomes. They only hear about the occasional times when, to their way of thinking, things don't turn out so well.
Right.
And I also, for a while, I was really bothered by the depiction of diplomats in films in particular, because they always seem to be, diplomats always seem to be presented in a negative light. And I thought that was really unfair.
Yes.
So I'm always glad when I hear accounts from American citizens that they had a good experience interacting with the embassy.
It happens a lot more than people think. Okay, so that was Guatemala. And from there, I understand you went to Indonesia.
Right. So for total change of surroundings, I wanted to experience something. I now have two Spanish-speaking countries in which I'd served. So I was ready for a change. And I bid on and was lucky enough to be sent to Indonesia, which in over my career was the most exotic country I worked in. It's really a fascinating country, and I always wanted to go back. I didn't go back as part of my career, but I did go back after I retired, and it's an amazing country. But anyway, I wanted to just make your listeners think about another aspect of serving in a foreign country on behalf of the U.S. government. During part of my time in Indonesia, I really started feeling badly. And so I was told to go to see a doctor that the embassy recommended, and I did. And he told me that he thought I was experiencing menstrual cramps. And I told him, you know, I'm not a teenager. I've been around this a lot, and I don't think this is menstrual cramps. But he told me that's what he thought it was, and he gave me some pain pills and told me to go home. So I did. And it just so happened that the next day I was scheduled to go to an outer island with the ambassador on a delegation to take the United States out to the outer islands. Now, for those who might not know, Indonesia is actually an archipelago. So it's 13,000 different islands, some of them big, some of them small. But we were going out way, way, way out to one of the furthest islands called Ambon. And we were going to do a whole series of programs about the United States there. And this is my area. This is taking the United States out to the people. So I was in charge of a lot of the events that we had out there, including writing speeches for the ambassador, having the ambassador talk to the news media, having some cultural events and so forth. So I did that. And since I planned for a long time for my husband to come out and meet me, because I wanted to stay on in Ambon for a couple of days and just experience the culture. I was feeling badly this whole time, but I was taking those pain pills. And my husband and I went out. And one of the things we did was we went snorkeling out in these beautiful, unspoiled areas and had a great day. And I actually felt better in the water than I did out of the water. But then when we got, you know, we're on the plane going home, I really, really, really was in pain. So when I got home, I called again the regional medical officer and I said, look, there's something wrong and it's not menstrual cramps. And he said, okay, go to the hospital and they'll check you out. So I went to the hospital and they're speaking Bahasa Indonesia, the language of Indonesia, which I had learned at a not as high a level as I speak Spanish for sure, just a very basic level and certainly not a lot of medical terms. And late in the afternoon, after they'd done a lot of tests on me, I called my husband and I said, look, I don't know what's happening here, but I can tell you based on past experience, they are prepping me for an operation. You better get over here. And of course, we also called the regional medical officer and he talked to the Indonesian doctors and he called me back and said, yeah, they're going to operate on you. And I said, for what? I had no idea what was wrong with me. And I had no idea how serious it was. From the way they were talking, I thought they might have thought they'd found cancer. But I wasn't, you know, I didn't know. And they wouldn't tell me. They just said it's exploratory. Now, the other piece of information you need to know is that for any serious condition, we would go to Singapore because the doctors in Singapore were considered the best in the region. We wouldn't have had an operation in Indonesia. So I asked the doctor, why are we doing this here in Jakarta? Why aren't I going to Singapore? And he said, you know, we don't want to risk you going on a plane again. Something could happen on the plane. You need to go ahead and just have the operation in Jakarta. And I did. And it turned out in the end, it was not cancer. It was appendicitis. Mm-hmm. But my appendix was on the point of bursting. And if it had, I would have been in, as they say, out east, very deep kimchi. Luckily, everything went well and I recovered and everything was fine. But anyway, I'm telling you this story just because I want you to realize that diplomats put their lives in danger for a lot of reasons, and one of which is just health. I had a colleague who contracted malaria while he was serving in Indonesia. I had this appendicitis attack. Other people have really serious medical problems and they're not home where they get the best medical care. They're having to put their medical history and their lives in the hands of foreign doctors. Mm. So we accept that risk and we do it willingly, but it is a risk.
Yes. Okay, Julie, well, that's Indonesia. Now, what other assignments? I know you were on a couple more. What other assignments were you on and what are some stories from them?
Well, the country I get asked a lot about is Colombia. And I actually went to Colombia twice. I chose to ask to return to Colombia. By the way, I also went to Israel twice. And again, I chose to return. It's not that usual for a diplomat to return to a country they've served in earlier. My own opinion is that we should do more of that. But anyway, I went to Colombia the first time from 1990 to 1992. And this is when Pablo Escobar, the Medellin cartel, and also the Cali cartel were, let's say, at their height. They were in control of large sections of the country. The government was really restricted to the major cities. You couldn't travel in the countryside. And the cartels were going about blowing up malls and buildings and killing officials and police. Many, many police were killed. And I went to Colombia as the deputy director of the narcotics affairs section. This was an out of cone, we call it. The cones are your areas you work in, like political or economic, or in my case, public affairs. This was an out of cone assignment. And I took it because I wanted to be assigned once with my husband. And he was in Columbia, so I went to be where he was. And in order to do that, I took an out-of-cone assignment. And I thought at the time that it was just a detour in my career, if I can put it that way. But it turned out to be good for me later in my career. At that time, my job was mainly inside the embassy. And we were trying to protect judges and police officers and officials who were fighting the drug war on behalf of Colombia. And of course, by being on behalf of Colombia, they were on behalf of the United States, because we were trying to keep the drug trafficking from coming to the United States. So my main job at that time was what we call trying to make sure that the aid we were giving the Colombians was really going where it was destined. So for example, we were supplying armored cars and bulletproof vests and communication equipment to Colombian judges. Now the judges were, if someone got arrested, if a drug trafficker got arrested, they would go before the Colombian judicial system. And whoever judge got the unlucky job of having to have that case really was putting a big X on themselves. But not just on themselves, it was on their mother, their father, their children, their wife, their whole extended family, because the drug cartels knew no bounds in what they would do to protect themselves. And so we were trying to protect the judges as best we could and to still have the cases go forward, because we wanted these drug traffickers to be sentenced. So it was a very violent time and a very difficult time. And as someone who was in charge of making sure that our aid was used properly, I would have to check every month and send in a report to Washington to which officials the armored cars were assigned, who was got the communication equipment and so forth. And so because of that, most of the embassy officers were not allowed to travel to Medellin and Cali because they were so dangerous. And of course, they were the headquarters of those two big cartels. But I got, with a lot of cajoling and pleading, special permission to go in. And it would be, you fly in the morning, you get met by the police, you're escorted everywhere by the police, and before dark, you get out of Dodge, you know, you leave town. And that's what I did. And I went to meet the police and see what they were doing with their equipment and confirm that, yes, this armored car numbers blank, 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 blank is in this assigned location. So I did that. And again, not many officers had the chance to visit Medellin and Cali, but I did. And I can tell you that, in my opinion, again, American tax dollars were being spent very well in Colombia. And if we've had a foreign policy success over the last 30 years, Colombia is it.
Oh, yes.
In my second tour, I went back, and frankly, it was a changed country in Colombia when I went back, because a very strong president had come in. He managed to wrest control of much of the country from the cartels, and the situation was very much turned around. When I was there, 90 to 92, Colombia was very close to being what theorists called a failed country. And when I went back later, you know, it was just an amazingly different country. And that wasn't, the United States government helped. We were an important help, but it was the will of the Colombian people that turned that situation around. So because when I went back, I was now the director of the narcotics affairs section. And I mentioned that when I did it earlier, I thought it was a detour in my career and not necessarily helpful. But when I went back, I was now the director of that section because I'd had that early experience of being the number two in that section.
Right.
And for those 2 years that I was in that position, I was protected 24 hours a day. I rode in an armored car everywhere I went. I had a dedicated driver and I had a dedicated bodyguard who rode with me in the armored car with a machine gun at all times. Hmm. So I was judged to be very much a target. Now, in fact, I still believe that the greater targets were policemen and judges in Colombia than me, because the cartels would not want to anger the U.S. government and have them make an even greater effort than they already were. But that was my opinion. The opinion of the embassy and the government was that I needed to be protected. So I was. And I had some incredible experiences there. Mm-hmm. Being able to ride on helicopters with the Minister of Defense to go out to forward operating bases to see what the police and the army were doing to try. By the way, Colombia was fighting a dual war. I was involved in the side fighting the drug cartels, but the Colombian government was also fighting the guerrillas that were then active in the country. So I got to ride on helicopters with high-level officials. I got to meet with the president of Colombia. I got to have conversations with people way out, what you might call it, Fort Apache. They were surrounded by either drug cartel people or guerrillas, but they stayed on to defend their patch. It was an amazing 2 years.
Wow. You're right on the front lines of the battle against the cartels. That's amazing. So, and a lot of your job was to protect the Colombians who were assisting America in fighting the cartels.
Exactly. The U.S. Congress decided that we wanted no military on the ground. Right. So there were no U.S. Army fighting in Colombia. But what we did do was train. We trained both the army and the police, because mm-hmm. the police were very involved in fighting the drug cartels. So we gave them a lot of help, which included material, but also training. Mm-hmm. And that was very important. And we ran a spray operation where we sprayed both marijuana, but opium. So I ran that program. It was a $500 million program. And I ran a fleet of 200 aircraft, mainly helicopters and spray planes.
Wow.
So it was, as far as the size of the program, that was the biggest program I ran during my career. Again, I had more funds at my fingertips than most ambassadors, and I had more power in the sense of 200 aircraft than most ambassadors do. So it was a very, very important assignment for me, because I felt I really was making a difference.
Yes, yes. Well, this was Eric Keene with So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And here's what's going on in the storytelling world in the Houston area as we speak. The Houston Storytellers Guild sponsors our show, and you can find out more about them by going to their webpage at houstonstorytellers.org. The Guild features monthly story swaps, as well as other storytelling workshops and events, and their next big event is the annual Liars Contest, which is a lot of fun. That'll be on April 30th, and you can find out about that and their other events by going to houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, click on the link for our radio show, So What's Your Story? There you can go to the archives and listen to every single show we've aired since 2008, 14 years worth. Also, we'd like to put in a good word for our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. They hold monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month at the Warehouse Live on Emmanuel Street. So come to the Moth and hear some great stories, or maybe even get up there and tell one of your own. And to take your storytelling skills to the next level, you can check out the Tejas Storytelling Organization at tejasstorytelling.com. Well, let's get back to our guest today. Her name is Julie Giannoloni, who was a career diplomat for 33 years at the U.S. State Department, and she is now retired and writing books. Now, after you retired, Julie, I understand that you got involved in this Camino de Santiago pilgrimage. Could you tell us a story about that?
Well, yes. Let me just say that I first heard about the Camino Santiago a long time ago, in the early 70s. When I dropped out of college, I went to live and work in Portugal. And my roommate at the time was a New Zealander. And she said to me, you need to read this book. And it was The Iberia by James Michener. Now, in those years, James Michener was a really big author here in the United States. He's not so heard of nowadays, but his book on Iberia is wonderful. And I still think it's one of the best books you can read about Spain, and to a much lesser degree, Portugal. Anyway, I read Iberia, and yes, I loved it. I learned a lot about the Iberian Peninsula, its history, its culture, from that book. Mm-hmm. Chapter 13 in Iberia is about the Camino de Santiago. which I had never heard about before. And frankly, in 1972, not many Americans had heard about it. During the Middle Ages, it was a very popular pilgrimage route. And by that, I mean, Christians would go to Santiago de Compostela in northwestern Spain to visit the shrine, the grave of St. James the Apostle. He is buried there, or that is what the church says. The other two popular pilgrimage sites were Rome, of course, and Jerusalem. And in my life, I've had the luck to visit all three of those sites. But anyway, in the Middle Ages, in the 1200s and 1300s, hundreds, thousands of Europeans would trek from their home across the Pyrenees, across northwestern Spain, and end up at Santiago. And if you've ever heard of or read the Canterbury Tales, which was not going to one of the three major sites, but going to Canterbury in England, it's the same story. People walk out their doors, they travel down to a pilgrimage site, they have their adventure, their experience, and their religious experience, perhaps, and then they return home. So that's what the pilgrimage is. Now, after I read chapter 13 of Iberia and knew I wanted to do this, I was at that time living on the economy in Portugal. I had neither the time nor the money to be able to do that pilgrimage. I didn't do it. But it was in the back of my mind. It was in the back of my mind forever that I wanted to do that. And so I decided when I knew I was approaching retirement that my first long trip was going to be to do this pilgrimage. And in the intervening years between 1972 and when I retired in 2014, there was a resurgence of interest in the pilgrimage caused by a lot of factors. One of them was that Martin Sheen and his son, Emilio Estevez, made the film The Way, which is his father following this route along a pilgrimage route because his son died as he was going along that route. So that happened much later than me, but it really sparked great interest. So the year before the pandemic, more than 300,000 people did this pilgrimage and got their proof that they did the pilgrimage, which is called a Compostela. It's a certificate given out by the church to say they have done a recognized pilgrimage. Well, anyway, I knew I wanted to do this. And by the time I got around to doing it, it was clear it wasn't going to be doing it in the way Michener did it, which was basically he drove it. But now I had to walk it. That's the most common way to do it. So I started preparing to do that, and I did walk it. I did what's called the French route of the Camino, which is about 500 miles long. If you start at the common starting place, which is in a little town on the French side of the Pyrenees, your first day out, you cross the Pyrenees, and then you walk all across northern Spain till you get to Santiago de Compostela, which is fairly close to the Atlantic Ocean. And so I planned to do that originally. And in the end, my son came with me, and thank goodness he did. We had a lot of experiences, both, I would say, spiritual and just physical along the Camino. Then I'll just tell you a real brief one. One day we were walking and we came across this section kind of in the mid-afternoon that was shale and it was descending. So you're on these flat sort of rocky things. Whenever you put your foot down, your foot usually slips. And another slip, and each step is slipping. So I had my walking poles with me, which give me another point of security, but it's still extremely slippery. And in the past, I'd already broken my ankle once, and my real fear was that I would fall and break my ankle. And this is out in the middle of nowhere. And how would any rescuers even get to me? And how would they carry me out? I'm not a small person. How are they going to carry me out of this place and get me somewhere? So I was really, really scared. And I was moving very slowly, making sure my poles were planted and making sure my feet were secure before I shifted my weight to another foot and moved forward. Slow, slow going. And my son, meanwhile, being, you know, he's 40 years younger than I am, he's scampering along. So it started getting dark. And so now I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be caught on this hillside in the dark and have to spend the night out here. So I asked my son, I said, look, why don't you go on ahead? tell the place where we have reserved our room. We're on our way. We're coming. Don't give up our room. Don't give it away to somebody else. And I'm coming as quickly as I can. And then you can double back and we'll meet up and finish. And he said, fine. So off he went to make sure that we had a place to spend the night. And I'm still inching my way down this mountainside. And all of a sudden I hear this whoosh, and this bicyclist barrels past me, and the whole two or three bicyclists. And let me say that a lot of people bicycle the route, and that's another approved way. Particularly Italian and the French seem to bicycle the Camino, and they go in groups. They don't do it by themselves. So this was, I mean, these are a group of like seven or eight men, all in their bike attire, you know, Lycra knit tops, tight fitting, and their bicycle shorts and so forth. Well, one of the men put on his brakes, so the shale is scattering all around me. And he stops and he says, in Italian, which I don't speak, but I speak very good Spanish, so I understood him. He said, do you need help? Well, I thought about that because, yes, I really did need help. But no, I mean, what can a man on a bicycle do to help me? So I thanked him very much. And I said that one thing he could do is he went down, if he saw a young man coming back this direction, tell him his mother is safe and on her way down. So he said, are you sure? Is that all you want? I said, yeah, that'll be very helpful. He offered me water because water along the Camino is a very important thing. But I thanked him and said I had water. And with that, he also sped off. Now, imagine this. I am inching on foot down this slope. And these Italian bicyclists are zooming down it. And all the time I'm thinking, if they have a tumble and go head first into these rocks, goodness, that's not going to be a good outcome for any of them. But they were fearless. They just went down speeding, I mean, fast as you can imagine. So eventually I made my way all the way down and met up with my son. And I asked him, did an Italian bicyclist stop and talk to you? And he said, yes, he did. He did. And he assured me you were okay and still on your way down. So I'm offering that because, first of all, it's funny. But also it says the Camino is on the whole safe, but there are patches of it which can be dangerous.
Oh yeah.
And thirdly, it is an example of the kindness that we experience all along the Camino of people who don't know us, who have no reason to help us, offering help as that Italian bicyclist did.
Right.
And that is one of the beauties and the wonders of the Camino.
Yeah, I'd never heard of the Camino until a friend of mine, Monica, she's in her 70s. She went on it and she had some fascinating story. And it, like you say, was a life-changing experience for her, for a lot of people. She's in her 70s and she's planning on going again. So it must be a special pilgrimage.
Yes, I've already done a second pilgrimage, quite different from the first one. And I plan to write my second book about that. I'm sorry, my third book. My first book is about this adventure I had walking the Camino. And I wrote a second book on a international adoption. But my third book, which I haven't yet written, but I'm going to, is on my second pilgrimage.
Now, Julie, you were in a male-dominated field for over three decades. And now you're very much involved in women's projects. So you would probably know just as much as anyone how things have changed over time for women officials in the State Department. Do we still have very far to go to achieve equality, or where are we at there?
You're absolutely right about being in a male-dominated field. It is still a male-dominated field. When I was serving earlier in my career, I had a senior officer at the embassy say to me, directly to me, that he felt the Foreign Service was better when there were no women officers, that women did a vital role as spouses. And he, without saying it, he was telling me what I knew, is that many spouses serve as unpaid, unofficial, also diplomats for our country. So in that sense, American citizens were getting two for the price of one. But it wasn't fair to women. They were being asked to do jobs, tasks, duties for the American government for which they were not remunerated. I was a woman at a time when there weren't very many women, and now the numbers for women entering the Foreign Service are larger. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, what we see is that women still are not progressing to the top of the profession. So when you look at the top career jobs, only about a third of those positions are held by women. And the rest are all career males. And part of the thing that I did in the Foreign Service was spend a lot of time working on women in the career issues. And I founded and was the first president of a group called Executive Women in State to look at the glass ceiling and try to figure out what was going on.
Right.
Now, I think a lot of people outside the State Department probably have the wrong impression because we've had a couple of women who were secretaries of state, Madeleine Albright and Condoleezza Rice. But what you have to understand is they were not career Foreign Service officers. They were political appointees. And nowadays, if you look at women in the State Department, assistant secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, you might see women there and think, oh, there's quite a lot of women leading the State Department. Well, yes, but they're political appointees. They are not career officers. If you start looking at career officers who hold important positions, they are almost all men. Mm-hmm. Now, we do have one breakthrough. Our current ambassador to the United Nations, which different administrations make it a cabinet level of position or not a cabinet level position. But anyway, our current ambassador to the United Nations is a career Foreign Service woman. So I'm very happy to see that happening, but it's not what usually happens. So I was considered myself extremely lucky to be promoted to the senior Foreign Service, which again, it's not that many women entering get that opportunity.
Right. And you were the equivalent of a two-star general?
That is correct.
That is getting up there. You know, Julie, I got to tell you, as far as women being involved in male-dominated fields, I was an MP, a military police officer in the Army, a long time ago, in the 1970s. And when I first started, women were not allowed to be MPs. It was only men. And by the time I got out, 3 years later, they'd started allowing women in. And I can tell you, that's the best thing that ever happened to the military police corps. It changed the whole complexion. Everything got more professional. So we need women in every aspect of government work.
Well, I certainly know that women bring a new perspective. And I also believe that women are important, are fundamental to changing conditions in a country. Women are the primary bread preparers, the child raisers, the people who keep the society stable, and yet very little attention is usually paid to them.
Right.
Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, did a lot to put more focus on women.
Good.
And to assist women overseas. And I think she deserves a lot of credit for that. And she's not often given the credit that she rightly deserves.
How does one become an employee of the State Department like you were?
There's a very well-defined route, whether you want to be a Foreign Service officer, as I was, or a civil service officer working at the State Department in Washington, D.C. Foreign Service is a very long and complicated route. It took me 2 years from the time I applied till I was offered a job. Nowadays, the State Department has tried to cut it down to 18 months. It has a series of steps. First, you have to pass a written exam. Then you have to pass an oral interview. Then your background is thoroughly checked out. Then you have to have an overall vetting for your scores and how you've done. And then if there are employment opportunities, you might get offered a position. Sometimes there's hiring freezes. Sometimes they're not. They're not hiring people. So you have to have a bit of luck also. But if you make it through the process, then you get offered a position to go into training in Washington, D.C. That's for Foreign Service officers. Civil service officers who serve mainly in Washington have a different route. They apply on their skills. So it's a resume-based application process. And those jobs are all posted, as all government jobs are, on the government website. And again, it's not easy because these jobs are really coveted. A lot of people want to be Foreign Service officers. But if you have the dedication and the interest, you can do it. Because I, with my farm 4-H background, managed to get myself sufficiently educated and ready to join. You can do it too.
Great advice. Well, Julie, I'd like to thank you for being here with us. And thank you for your service over the years. And understand, before we let you go, I understand you have a couple of books Could you tell us about those?
Eric, yes, thank you. I have two books. They don't seem at all alike, but they are. The thread that carries them through is travel and international aspect. So my first book is Savoring the Camino de Santiago. It's about that pilgrimage that I was talking about earlier. And the second book is a book on international adoption called The Baby with Three Families, Two Countries, and One Promise. And it is for children. It's a children's book. It's for those interested, or those who have an adopted child, or who are interested in adopting a child. And you can look up all of my work on my one of my two websites, BayouCityPress.com. BayouCityPress.com. I have an author website too, which if you really want to read more about me, you can go and look at. And that's JulieConnorAuthor.com.
And I just wanted to backtrack a little bit. Now, you yourself adopted an international child, correct?
I did. My son was born in Colombia.
So you'd be an expert on that subject, I'd say.
Well, I'm an expert on my experience, but everybody's experience is different.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to do with my book was have a book that a parent could take and adapt to their own child's experience.
Great. So. Well, Julie, I've really appreciated your stories here today. Thank you for being our guest, and good luck to you in all your future endeavors.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you to the listeners who have taken the time to hear about my Foreign Service life.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that is our show for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed Julie Giannelloni's stories as much as I did. And don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower is up next with a sweet mix of soul on R&B Gold. Make KPFT 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
I was towed in my pack along the dusty when a mucker rolled up, when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to win a muck-a-mack with me, you can ride. So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, that I said, listen, bud, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. Metairie, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Panama, Appaloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Hercule, Amadillo.
Woman in Congress. The low number of women in senior congressional positions was most dramatically underscored following the 1992 elections. Much publicized as the Year of the Woman, a record number of women were ushered into Congress. Yet, there was not a single woman who held a committee chairmanship in the democratically controlled Congress. The situation improved when the Republicans took control following the 1994 election. Congresswoman Jan Myers was promoted to a chairmanship.
Yes, I think they accept us as political equals. I truly do. I'm a committee chairman in the Republican Party. I am the first committee chair for a very long time to be a woman, I think, in either party.
Women in Congress, a historical look at the role of women in the political process, Tuesday afternoons at 4 on KPFT.
Pacifico Radio is doing what it does best.
And the rich white companies are jumping the line so they can get access to the vaccine.
Covering the global pandemic.
I think people need to wake up and recognize that this is a fight against slavery.
The working class movement against racism and imperialism.
If we have a First Amendment, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere.
And holding politicians and corporate media accountable to the people. This and much more on COVID, race, and democracy. Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on KPFT. Houston. Don't miss it.
Happy 52nd birthday, KPFT. You sure are looking good. I'm Benicia Williams, owner of Nisi Communications, and a proud KPFT member. and this year's fundraising coordinator. Join us this entire month of March as we celebrate virtually 52 years of radio run by the community with our 52 on 52 birthday campaign. Just donate $52 or more to celebrate 52 years as Houston's community radio station. Go to our website, kpft.org, or call us at 713-526-5738 to donate. Once again, that's 713-526-5738. Happy birthday!